What does paradise look like for you? Pico Iyer's travels over some 50 years have included places where few typical travelers venture. And as Pico writes about his experiences in places as far-flung as Iran, Kashmir, Sri Lanka, North Korea, the Australian bush, and mountainside temples in Japan, he shares a thoughtful perspective that might help us recognize paradise wherever we are. Pico joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves from Kyoto in Japan. Pico, thanks for being with us.
Oh, such a pleasure to be with you again, Rick. Thank you.
Pico, you've been thinking a lot about paradise lately, and that's something that travelers just seem to crave when they go far away from home. What's your take on the typical traveler's appetite for paradise?
Well, I've always had that typical traveler's appetite. It was especially acute during the pandemic because there I was stuck at home with my 88-year-old mother. And like many of us, I think I started thinking about the places I'd been and 48 years of travel, which were the places that had really moved me. So I think at the best of times, many of us at home caught up in our routine, a longing for paradise, and in lockdown, not knowing when we could be on the road again, even more so. So in some ways, it was the perfect time for thinking about the places I'd been that might be considered as paradise and putting them to the test, as it were.
So there's some obvious places. I mean, you write about Bali, and if I think of what's paradise, I think of Bali, you know, mangoes and bungalows and flowers and angelic dancers. But you find there's always a sort of a paradox when you finally get there.
Yes, of course, if it is the Garden of Eden is the place with the serpent and the fatal apple. And just as you say, I remember the first time I traveled to Bali. I was living in New York City, got into a plane, suddenly arrived in this $2 a night cottage down the road from the beach, and beautiful people bringing me, as you say, fresh fruit and tea and my terrace and this golden sunshine. This is heaven. But of course, it wasn't necessarily heaven for the people around me because they were working very hard to make me comfortable. And I was coming from New York City, which is probably a place that they would see as paradise. So I think paradise is very much in the eye of the beholder. And one of the interesting things about it is my vision of paradise probably will never be exactly yours.
You know, that's so true. And it's sort of like the other person's grass is always greener.
Yes, and I think that's one reason sometimes I love trying to look at my hometown through foreign eyes or showing a visitor around my hometown. I remember during the pandemic, because I couldn't travel, I would start taking walks along the road behind my mother's house. And occasionally it'd be early in the morning, there'd be golden light coming up over the mountains, I'd turn around, I'd see the Pacific Ocean in the distance sparkling in the clear air. And I would think, my heavens, this is as beautiful as anything I'd go across the world to see in Cape Town or Rio de Janeiro. Here it is in my own backyard. And until the pandemic came, I'd never thought to walk to the end of the road behind my mother's house, though she'd been there for 50 years.
That's just very thought-provoking that paradise can be hiding out. You were talking about Bali, and I remember my time in Bali in a $2 thatched hut. I remember so charmed by the restaurants, the menu and all the exotic fruits that I asked him if I could keep the menu, and I still have that menu because it had fruits on it that I never encountered and I have yet to see since. And I remember when it got dark, walking through the dirty lanes, and then all of a sudden there was mean dogs. In the distance there was like a pagoda kind of structure where they had a gamelan orchestra playing. And it was just thriving, all those xylophones pounding away. And it was just like sort of a heavenly train rhythm, you know. And I just didn't know if this is, you know, with the dog and with the darkness and with the gamelan, it was sort of a mix. It was heaven and hell at the same time.
Oh, Rick, exactly. I remember those dogs barking in the night in the back streets of Bali, and very spooky sound of the gamelans, as you say. And the people who are performing these beautiful dances are in a trance. They're sometimes simulating the great legendary battle of black magic and white there. And I remember, probably I was at Bali around the first time, around the same time as you, and I'd walk down the little streets and they were all selling masks. And so many of the masks were of gods or spirits or demons, much too charged for me to buy. But finally, I saw this little red, yellow, green mask of an owl. I thought, this is very innocent. It looks like a perfect thing for a goddaughter. So I bought it and I took it back home to New York City. And as soon as I got back home, I put the mask on the wall And it was so powerful, I had to take it down and put it away and never look at it again. It just reminded me that there's more going on in these cultures than the typical visitor can read. And it's really magnetic and packs a powerful
charge. That's important for us to remember as people in search of paradise, that paradise, when you get there, the more you know about it, the more reality sinks in. You know, the title of your book, Pico, The Half-Known Life. Can you explain to us what the half-known life is?
Yes, I think it has two parts. And the first, I know you and I have spoken about before, which is my feeling that in this age of information, we actually know less about the world than ever before. And sometimes we know least of all about the countries we hear most about. Cuba, Iran, North Korea, they're always in our headlines. And yet, when we hear those names, we just see one face, or we just know a little bit about their economy, but so little about daily life and regular folks. Beneath that, though, I, as I get older, come to think that the most important parts of our lives come from things that we can't begin to explain. Suddenly, you fall in love. Suddenly, you walk out onto a terrace outside a temple in Tibet and you're rendered speechless. Suddenly, your house burns down in a fire, as happened to me. Suddenly, a pandemic locks down the entire world. And I think we're almost defined by what we do with what we can't explain. And really the powerful things in life, love, faith, terror, wonder, those dances you were just describing in Bali, they're all outside our reach, which makes them so fascinating, but sometimes unsettling too.
I love that idea of a useful humility. Sometimes I'm overwhelmed by emotions and I don't even know where it came from. And, you know, it relates to faith, it relates to love, it relates to fear. And maybe part of our challenge is just being comfortable with the fact that a lot of life lies beyond our grasp.
Yeah, and I think that's the beauty of travel. It humbles me every single time, in every way. And I know that when I'm sitting at home, I think about Iran or Cuba or Bali, I think I know it all. I'm on top of things. I've followed the newspaper. I've listened to your show. I know everything about them. And then as soon as I get off the plane in Damascus or Havana or Tehran, I see I don't know a thing. This is everything interesting about those places is what I hadn't known about. And that's what makes it exciting.
I'm with you. And I was just, when you were talking about that, remembering my first trip to Japan. Japan so befuddled me. In fact, it so befuddled me that people made a habit of looking at me and seeing there's a very befuddled person. And they would always help me. I just looked like a man that needed help. And I enjoyed it. I laughed at myself. I didn't know if it was the in or the out or how to eat this or what to do with that. And it was sort of a playfulness that I stopped trying to be in control and I just enjoyed people's friendliness. I enjoyed the being steep on the learning curve. I enjoyed my stumbles. And it made Japan one of my favorite places to explore. And I've never quite put my finger on it until right now.
And the beauty of Japan, as you know, is it's endlessly befuddling and bewildering beyond our grasp. I've been here 35 years now, and I do in many ways feel I know less than when I arrived. I remember the first time I came to Japan, 1985, I wrote a 40-page article explaining everything about Japan. And now I've actually lived here for 35 years, I could barely manage a haiku, which I like about it.
I read that book and I thought, oh, Pico, you made it so easy. But now you tell me, oh, it's not quite that easy.
No, I was really writing from the position of a bewildered foreigner. And in this book, The Half-Known Life, one conscious thing I try to do is in almost every chapter, I'm in the passenger seat being led around by a local. And that's to remind me just of what you said, that I'm not in the driver's seat. I'm not in control. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And that's why I love traveling.
Pico Iyer pulls together observations and life lessons from his nearly 50 years of roaming the world, sometimes to places where others feared to tread. It's the focus of his latest book, called The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. It's even been called A Guided Tour of the Human Soul. Pico's a best-selling author of more than a dozen books, and his articles appear in Time magazine and in the New York Times. His TED Talks have received millions of views. His website is picoiyerjourneys.com. And Iyer is spelled I-Y-E-R. It's interesting that when we think of paradise, a lot of times it's tranquility, it's peacefulness, it's just calmness. But when I think of my favorite places, they are chaotic places. And I don't know why my paradise is chaos. It might have something to do with people and the commotion and the conviviality of people coming together. But India is, I think, my favorite country. And in Europe, it is Italy. And in Italy, you know, they celebrate their chaos. They call it Bella Chaos, the beautiful chaos. You know, paradise maybe doesn't have to be a perfect never-never land that is so tranquil and peaceful.
I love that idea, because really the paradise you can find in the middle of real life is a paradise you can trust, the kind of paradise you find in the chaos of India or amidst the tumult of Italy. Because I sometimes find, as we've been saying, I will sit along a golden beach on a sunny day. Of course, this is paradise. But the sunshine only lasts for 10 hours. And the next day, maybe I'll get sick or there'll be 100 people on that beach. So a paradise that is based on beautiful circumstances is probably pretty fragile and not really open to everybody. But a paradise you can find in the middle of crowded Varanasi is one that I have faith in.
There you go. The paradise where everything's great and you got your masseuse on the beach and your fresh squeezed juice. Somebody's working really hard, probably at subpar wages, to bring that to you. It's not quite as paradisical as it might seem. But to be in there in Varanasi, oh my goodness, you wrote about that in this book so vividly. Of all the places in India, you know, you wrote about the holy city of Hinduism, the river Ganges as it flows through Varanasi. Can you take us down to the river and explain to us what we're going to experience?
I can. I mean, Varanasi, as you know, and anybody who's been to India knows, is the single most intense, shocking, displacing city in the whole of shocking, intense, displacing India. To the north and to the south, as you stand along the holy river Ganges, there are flames burning through the day and through the night, reducing dead bodies to ash and bones. And when you walk through the little narrow lanes of the old city, people are permanently racing through, singing with joy as they carry the dead bodies of their loved ones to commit to the flames or to the holy waters. There are, as you remember, ascetics walking around completely naked, except smeared with ash, who are living in graveyards and drinking from skulls to convey their indifference to conventional morality. And there are also lots of people washing and sometimes drinking in the holy waters, the holy waters that contain, according to the WHO, 3,000 times more fecal bacteria than is safe for human consumption. So it's a wild scene.
Crazy as it is, this is where devout Hindus want to go to end their life and escape into some kind of paradise. I mean, Hindus believe those people who are burned and cremated there, that will free them from the cycle of rebirth, right?
Exactly. It's liberation. And one of the things that's, again, humbling and eye-opening there is that the city of death really is a city of joy, as everyone is experiencing, shouting with praise and thanksgiving to be there. And it's interesting, too, because I am Indian by birth on both sides. I'm 100% Hindu by birth. And yet even I am sort of freaked out by this place, but moved to see everybody so jubilant to be in the midst of this chaos.
Pico, I think one of your, part of the magic juice you have as a travel writer is you're a very spiritual person, I feel, but you're not exclusively one faith. And you can see the road as church, as well as the road as a playground. And I've been kind of exploring that idea, because when you're travelers, you can be a tourist, you can be a traveler, or you can be a pilgrim. And I think it's fun to mix it all together. Tell me a little bit about how your interest in spiritual issues sort of makes your writing more insightful, I would say.
Well, thank you, Rick. I want to steal that phrase about road as church, because it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think one reason all of us leave home is that at home, as I said before, we think we know it all. Our days are very planned out. As soon as we're in the middle of the unknown, we're in this presence of these things that we can't understand. I find I trust people much more mm-hmm. when I'm in a foreign place than when I'm at home. I'm kinder when I'm on the streets of Varanasi and I see somebody extending a hand. I'll give her time and maybe help the way I wouldn't when I'm in my busy life in California. And I believe much more when I'm traveling, because I see so much that confounds belief and that I can't begin to explain.
Yes.
I live much more in a sort of rational, logical world when I'm at home. So I love the way that travel opens us up to wonder and therefore to kind of an understanding of...
I think it makes us small. It enables us to get closer to God. It helps us see everybody as children of God and therefore brothers and sisters. And when we travel, we get to know the family. And that's not unique to any particular religion. I mean, think of the importance the Hajj has in the teachings of Muhammad. That's one of the five pillars of Islam, is you're supposed to go on a pilgrimage, ideally to Mecca, but not necessarily to Mecca. And I think the idea is get away from your home and realize you can learn more about yourself and your home by leaving it and looking at it from a distance.
And joining all the fellow travelers who are walking in the same direction with the same motivation, learning about community, I think. And exactly as you say, for example, I love going to Jerusalem. I'm not Muslim, I'm not Christian, and I'm not Jewish, but there are many places in that town, for all its conflicts, that move me to tears. I think places have a magnetism, as people do, and they have a power beyond our comprehension. Mm. And places like Varanasi and Jerusalem, partly because of 2,000 years of worship and pilgrims, but also just because of what they are.
Yes.
Take us out of ourselves.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with author Pico Iyer. And Pico examined some of the world's most potent holy sites in his latest book, The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. You can find links to Pico's work in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. And you can learn more about Pico from his website. It is picoiyerjourneys.com. Pico, you wrote that as we grow more and more connected, we're becoming more and more divided. That's so insightful.
I've been lucky enough to spend 48 years talking and traveling with the Dalai Lama. And it's so interesting. This most respected of religious figures wrote a book called Beyond Religion, because he sensed that even religion was dividing us the way our political positions do, at a time when humanity really is sharing more than ever before. And you and I have the chance to experience cultures firsthand the way our grandparents couldn't have imagined. So I think it's up to us as travelers to find what unites us and not hide behind the doctrines or dogmas that divide. Mm.
You know, I've been wrestling with traveling in a warming world and the ethics of travel and so on. And I think a big part of that is the stewardship of when we travel to get something out of it. Your niche is to inspire us to give meaning to our travels. You wrote, travel has meaning only if it changes something within. Let's just wrap up our conversation, Pico Iyer, with your advice for how we can enjoy truly transformational travel.
As you said, I think just leave your assumptions at home. Know that you can learn from anybody and hope that you will come back a different person from the one who left. That's really my one criterion. I want to come back somewhat different than the Pico of 2 weeks ago.
And for me, that is the most beautiful souvenir. Pico Iyer, thank you for joining us. Best wishes with your travels and sharing the lessons of your travels.
Thank you, Rick. Always such a pleasure.
You can listen to Pico Iyer's earlier visits with us on Travel with Rick Steves from our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. European cities weren't always as easy to bike or walk around as many of them are today. City planning consultant Jeff Speck explains what he's been advising cities in North America to do to reduce pedestrian fatalities and to make their cities as enjoyable and people-friendly as the places we fly thousands of miles to visit. Explore what it takes to be a walkable city. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves.